I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Polls have been telling us Americans have been itching to vote political insiders out and outsiders in, and disaffected voters on the left and the right were going to help throw incumbents overboard. Well, that happened somewhat in yesterday's primaries. In Nevada, Republican Governor Jim Gibbons was voted out. Also in Nevada, Tea Party favorite Sharon Engel won the GOP Senate primary. She'll face Harry Reid in the fall. And in South Carolina, Tea Party favorite Nikki Haley got the most votes in the GOP governor's primary. Despite an ugly campaign that concluded accusations of infidelity, she still faces a runoff, so we'll be hearing a lot of those accusations again. But as far as the common wisdom, Time magazine's Jay Newton Small says, hold on. She joins us from Washington. And Jay, you write, in fact, a surprising number of establishment candidates survive challenges in a season where Washington's blessing often felt more like a curse. Go on.
Well, I had 9 races to watch going into this super primary Tuesday, and out of that, 5 of those races, either the establishment candidate or the incumbent won, which is really counterintuitive, which says to me that actually, in places like Arkansas, where Blanche Lincoln is a 2-term incumbent and everyone wrote her off as dead, in California, where the Republican Party got the 2 exact candidates that they really wanted, Carly Fiorina for Senate and Meg Whitman for governor, and even in Iowa, where a former 4-term governor, Terry Branstad came back again. I mean, he's sort of the definition of establishment, right? And and won his primary. And in Virginia, even in a House race where there were 6, Tea Party candidates, it was the 7th guy. It was the establishment guy, the state senator, that actually won the primary. So, I mean, these are all races where, in fact, voters were very pragmatic.
Well, let's talk about Senator Blanche Lincoln in Arkansas, who defeated candidate Lieutenant Governor Bill Halter, who'd been sort of called the progressive candidate. He was picked by MoveOn.org and MSNBC. And labor unions, they spent $10 million to defeat her. And if you listened to some of the commentators on MSNBC, this was all about her vote against the public option and her stand against the check cards that make it easier for workers to unionize. But did voters in Arkansas, go that deep? Did they care about those issues?
No, and in fact, look, I mean, voters in Arkansas is a very conservative state. There's virtually no unions. It's the home of Walmart. There's like 0.5 unions in this state. I mean, really. And they are a conservative state, and she voted very much in line with her state. So, yes, there's this anti-incumbent, anti-establishment fervor going on, but in fact, voters, when it came down to it, said, realized that she had a much better chance of winning in a general election against Representative John Bozeman, who's the Republican nominee. Yes, she's still the underdog in that race, but Halter was a very, very progressive guy, and there are maybe 15,000 pure progressives in the entire state of Arkansas.
And how did Republicans fare? Because the other conventional wisdom was that the Tea Party candidates were going to win. Some did, but you point out some didn't. And when they did the Republicans necessarily win?
No, and in fact, they had this in Nevada. Republicans thought forever that they really had this great case against Harry Reid, who's the Senate Majority Leader, and he's very vulnerable. His poll numbers are just terrible. And if Reid had, gift wrapped the candidate for himself, he could not have gotten a better candidate to run against because, this woman, Sharon Engel, who won the primary last night, is extremely right-wing. I mean, she believes in abolishing the departments of education and energy. She believes in abolishing the EPA, even, at a time when we're dealing with this massive oil spill in the middle of the Gulf. She's extremely, she's got these amazingly wacky views, which she got her into trouble towards the end of her primary about giving massages to prisoners and who are drug addicted in order to help them overcome their addictions.
Well, so Harry Reid will face her in the fall. The Democrats may be a sigh of relief, who knows. But just touch briefly on another narrative that came out of last night. Rich women winning big in California.
Absolutely. I mean, it was kind of amazing. Meg Whitman, who's the former CEO of eBay, spent $80 million in this primary, which is just a breathtaking amount of money. Carly Fiorina, who won the Senate primary, she's also the former CEO of Hewlett-Packard. She also spent tens of millions of dollars. So you've got a lot of people pouring these two women pouring a lot of money into California. It would have been actually incredibly amazing if they'd lost this race, given how much money they had spent. As Jerry Brown, who's the Democrat Democratic nominee for the gubernatorial race remarked snarkily towards the end of the primary that, you know, Meg Whitman and her opponent, Steve Poizner, spent $110 million running more than 100,000 advertisements against each other, and that's just a big gift to him.
Well, we'll see what happens in the fall, but Jay Newton Small, political correspondent for Time Magazine, thank you for helping us take a deeper look at last night's primary results. Jay, thanks.
Thank you.
BP's chief operating officer, Doug Suttles, is continuing to repeat the BP line that there are no large underwater oil plumes. Here he is responding to a question from Today Show host Meredith Vieira about yesterday's report from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration confirming the discovery of huge plumes of deep-sea oil from the BP well.
Well, Meredith, it may be down to how you define what a plume is here, but basically there, what some people have asked is are there large concentrations of oil under the sea? And those have not been found so far by us or anyone else that's measuring this. The oil that has been found is in very minute quantities.
So he's saying it depends on what the definition of plume is. Well, many lawmakers are outraged at the BP response, and there are moves in Congress to further regulate the oil industry, to extend bans on new offshore drilling and raise the cap on civil liability. But former Labor Secretary Robert Reich says it's time to take them over, or at least he's recommending that the government put BP into temporary receivership. Reich is professor of public policy at the University of California at Berkeley. Secretary Reich, welcome.
Hi, Robin.
Tell us what you mean, temporary receivership.
Essentially, the government would be taking over the operations of North America BP, using its expertise, using its resources, but be in charge of plugging up that hole and containing the oil spill and doing the cleanup. I just don't think it's commonsensical to have the company that was in all likelihood responsible for all of this, with a terrible health and safety record in the past, to be in charge.
And you also list some other reasons for doing this. You say they, along the way, we've been given bad information. But as you point out, this is a publicly held company. They're working in the interest of shareholders. Is that your biggest concern?
Yes. There's a big difference between a publicly held company that is maximizing shareholder returns and, on the other hand, a company really answerable and responsible to the best interests of the public. And what shareholders want and need may sometimes mean cutting corners with regard to public health and safety unless there are firm regulations in place or if there's a national emergency, unless the company is actually under the control of public officials and the president.
Okay, a couple of things. The Obama administration has said, first of all, BP has the technology and the know-how. I mean, the government doesn't pay scientists and engineers thousands of dollars to sit and wait for this. It's BP that has the technology. But also, there's the fear that in taking it over, calling this a national disaster, It then puts the onus on the taxpayer to pay for it. And the thinking was that if you want BP to pay for it, you have to keep it in their hands.
No, just actually the opposite. The only way that BP is going to actually pay for it, and we make sure that all the resources that BP has are going to be used appropriately, is to temporarily take BP over and use its expertise as well. Right now, financial markets in some quarters are even worried about whether BP is going to survive or can survive all the civil claims that may be heaping on top of it. The government needs to take action right now, Robin. It's very important for the president to show that he is in charge.
Okay, one other question, because we had a listener, an attorney named Stuart Gardner, write us and ask, why can't the Obama administration deputize BP in the way the Bush administration deputized Peter Pan bus lines or Avis or Burger King after Katrina so that these companies could do things like, you know, drive people from New Orleans to Texas, take a financial loss, but do the right thing and temporarily be relieved of responsibility to stockholders?
Deputize is to use resources that are out there to help with a national emergency of some sort. And Katrina was a natural national emergency. But here we have an emergency that's created by a company itself, by, in all likelihood, although we don't have a court ruling yet, its own negligence. We want to use its expertise. We want to use its resources. But it's not a matter of deputizing. It really is a matter of taking charge, making sure that all of the information it gives out is accurate, making sure it's using all its resources for the public purposes, and also making sure that it's really thinking about the public's risks and benefits when it's making decisions, such as whether to use toxic dispersants. Mm-hmm. I mean, the president doesn't have now any direct legal control over BP.
And you say that the Oil Pollution Act of 1990 would give the president implicit authority to do this temporary receivership. Is there precedent?
I think so. I mean, the White House lawyers would have to look at that. Harry Truman, President Truman, tried to seize the steel mills in the national emergency 1952 of the Korean War. The Supreme Court said he could not do that because there was not even an act of Congress that implicitly gave him that authority. Well, here we do have the Pollution Control Act of 1990, and as I read it, there is implicit authority.
And what about the fact that BP is a British corporation? It's not American.
Look, nationality has nothing to do with it. If an American corporation were wreaking havoc in another country, that country presumably would take over its that subsidiary's assets. This is a disaster that is large. National ownership really has nothing to do with it.
Your friend, Harvard sociology professor Theda Skocpol, your friend, but still, she says your idea of temporary receivership is nuts because it would give...
She doesn't mince words.
Right, because she says it would give the Obama administration ownership of a problem with no easy solution, and then they would definitely own it, which feeds right into people like Sarah Palin. But also, she says, why not let BP do its job and then hold them accountable in the courts?
Well, because the amount of damage that can happen in the interim is incalculable. It's already incalculable. And I think that I would argue it exactly the opposite way. I'd say that if the president does not actually take charge, as this thing gets worse and worse, as the environmental damage becomes more and more apparent, the president begins to look ineffectual.
You compare BP to Massey Energy, Goldman Sachs. You ask, what do they all have in common? And you say, they're all big firms involved in plunder, your word, cutting corners in the ocean, cutting corners not using regulated safety equipment in a mine, or the alleged fraud perpetrated by Goldman Sachs. But the other thing they have in common is regulators seem to be absent. Given that, do you think we need new regulations, or as the wife of a worker who was killed on the BP rig said, just enforce existing ones?
Well, both. Enforcing existing ones is obviously critical. The Department of Interior's Minerals Management Service was obviously asleep at the wheel, or worse. There may have been a lot of conflicts of interest there. But look at what happened with the Upper Big Branch mine when it exploded and Massey Energy basically said, well, we did everything we were supposed to do. Obviously untrue. The Mine Safety and Health Administration did try to fine the company for a whole string of violations, but the law didn't allow the fines to be big enough to deter the company, which raises obviously the question, given Massey's record, why didn't MSHA, the Mine Safety and Health Administration, seek changes in the law to increase the penalties? Or, Robin, you take the Securities and Exchange Commission. Yeah. And Goldman Sachs and all the other big banks, the SEC was asleep at the wheel, could have been, should have been enforcing laws. And if the laws were not adequate in terms of fines and penalties, these agencies should be making a fuss and going back to Congress and saying, we need more.
That's former Labor Secretary Robert Reich. He wants the government to put BP into receivership. We can talk more about that, but also what does he see for further regulation of the oil and other industries? I will have that in 1 minute here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with former Labor Secretary Robert Reich, who argues that the government should put BP into temporary receivership so that it's no longer responsible to its shareholders and their need for profit. And Reich says the disaster is just one example of the need for regulation from mining to Wall Street. Now, Congress is considering tougher regulations for financial markets. Let's list some. They include taming and regulating those risky bets, the derivatives that investment banks make. Also, trying to take the power that the government has through the Federal Deposit Insurance Company to shut failing banks and create the same kind of power to break up investment companies that become too big to fail. Suggestions to separate investment banking from regular savings banking, create a new agency to protect consumers from bad financial projects and unintelligible credit card and mortgage loan paperwork. So, Secretary Reich, these bills are out there, but we know banks are spending millions to fight this, and we're hearing Congress is not into passing it. You know, it would seem to be politically popular given the financial collapse. So why is this happening?
Now we get to the heart of the matter. Because whether you're talking about big oil companies or Wall Street or big energy companies like Massey, or even if you're talking about big health insurers like WellPoint, the fact of the matter is that they have lots of money and they influence legislators who write the rules by which regulations are actually crafted and through which and under which they are enforced. And as long as the big guys have that much money and as long as our members of Congress and senators are that dependent on campaign donations for their campaigns, we're going to have a repeat of exactly the same problem. We're going to have members of Congress and presidents who want to be tough, who act like they're tough, who say they're going to be tough, but then problem after problem after problem, because when you look closely, there are loopholes in the laws and there are regulators who don't want to be quite as aggressive.
But Robert Reich, what happened here? Because as you remind us in your blog, there's a history, a decades-long history of deregulation. And at a certain time, it was thought to be a good thing by Democrats. You have Ted Kennedy speaking at the 1980 Democratic National Convention, bragging about how it was the Democratic Party that ended excessive regulation in the airline and trucking industry, restored competition to the marketplace. Of course, you take that up through Reagan. But the thinking was that deregulation reduced cost for the consumer.
Well, deregulation did reduce the cost to the consumer, particularly economic regulation that was creating a monopoly with regard to trucking and airlines and gave them enormous power over regulators in setting prices. But we're talking now about a different category of regulation, health, safety, environmental regulation, and regulations against fraud. These kinds of regulations began to evaporate or disintegrate, starting with Ronald Reagan.
The safety regulations.
Health, safety, environment, and fraud. They're not economic issues per se. That is, it's not a matter of maintaining a monopoly for a particular industry or raising their prices and keeping their prices high because they have a monopoly. That's what trucking regulation was about. That's what airline regulation was about. That's all of the stuff that created the alphabet soup of regulatory agencies during the New Deal in an attempt to keep prices high because we were in a depression. No, I'm talking about a new category of regulation, health, safety, environmental regulation, and regulations against fraud, which did actually originate in the New Deal in terms of the Securities Act of 1933 and 34. These should never have been and should not be thought of as impediments to the public welfare. These are absolutely necessary balances to companies that are becoming under ever greater pressure to show higher and higher returns for investors.
We started with BP. Let's end with BP and the oil industry. What are the things that you think need to be done in that industry? We talked about tightening regulation, obviously cleaning up agencies like MMS, but what further regulation would you want to see?
Beside the government actually putting BP under receivership until this spill is contained and until the cleanup is done, I think that the president should order BP to put aside, let's say, $5 to $10 billion to make sure that it is there for cleanup. Beyond that, Robin, I think we've got to make sure that there is an actual firewall between the regulators and the industry. The Department of Interior's Minerals Management Service has got to be completely cleaned up, as do the other regulatory agencies that we've seen for so many years become too cozy with the industries they're supposed to regulate.
It feels awfully amorphous to people right now because on the one hand we hear about there's a ban on offshore drilling, but wait, that's just deep water drilling, not more shallow drilling. And we hear that there are companies that have been given leases just in the last couple of months and had exceptions to environmental reviews. What would you see with deep water drilling?
Well, this makes no sense at all. I think there has to be a moratorium on deep water drilling until and unless the government is satisfied that it is safe, that there are precautions far greater than there are today.
For instance, not just a blowout preventer, which they had, but a backup for your blowout preventer?
We think that a backup is going to be enough, but it has not been tested. And we know that you need at least one backup, but how do you know you don't need two backups? I mean, I think that if it were up to me, I'd say no deep water drilling at all, that it can never be safe because we just can't know enough about it. And this gets us ultimately to the question of how we wean ourselves off of our oil dependency.
Congressman Markey is considering a bill that would require that oil companies put up to $50 million, I believe, into a fund that would then be used to research new products and technologies for cleanup. We've been concentrating on the capping of the well, but as we look up and see, wow, we're using the same booms from 30 years ago to try to contain it. Is that the kind of thing you're thinking of, that it should be regulated?
Exactly. Regulation, old-style regulation is not enough. There's got to be a lot of innovation with regard to figuring out how these things can be prevented, and also if they are not prevented, if you have another one of these dangerous disasters, how the negative consequences, the terrible environmental hazards can be minimized. The industry ought to be doing this research, paying for the research. The government ought to be overseeing it. It should not have to be taxpayers. It should be the industry.
That's former Laker Secretary Robert Reich, now professor of public policy at the University of California at Berkeley. We'll link you to his arguments for stronger government oversight and regulation of industry at our website, hereandnow.org. Secretary Reich, thanks so much.
Thank you, Raman.
The UN Security Council today approved tough new sanctions against Iran because of its suspected nuclear program. As Iran braces for this weekend's anniversary of the disputed election of President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, Iranian opposition leaders are calling for new demonstrations to mark the anniversary. The BBC's John Line has this report.
They'd never seen anything quite like it in the history of the Islamic Republic. For a few weeks last June, really just a few days, the streets of Iran erupted into a spontaneous debate over the future of the country as President Ahmadinejad stood for re-election. Ali Hamadani witnessed the scenes before fleeing the country. He now works for the BBC.
I remember people were out, they were dancing in the street, they were challenging each other, they were talking about different candidates.
On election day, they poured out to vote, everyone with their own vision for the future.
We want more better relations with other countries. And we want more freedom, more and more freedom.
When they just got more Ahmadinejad, Iranians flooded out onto the streets to protest. The city authorities estimated that millions of people attended the largest demonstration in Tehran 3 days after the election. But soon the government's besieged militia were reasserting control. The world watched as demonstrators were beaten up. Opposition supporters reported they were tortured or even raped after they'd been arrested. 12 months on, the protests seem to have mostly petered out. But what's been the lasting effect? This is BBC Persian TV, and this is one of the reasons I was expelled from Iran. The Iranian authorities object to the BBC broadcasting into their country in Persian. They think it's an interference in their internal affairs. But the reason I've come here today is this is also a very good place to get information out of Iran. There are daily programs here in which, despite government pressure, many Iranians continue to phone and to email and to tweet, and they give their opinion about what is going on in the country right now. Pune Gurusi is one of the presenters who takes those calls and emails.
Some people think there is a revolution happening somewhere along the way and the change is irreversible, and the frustration and the anger that was caused since after the election is still rife in people. However, there's a different group of people who think, well, there was a discontent after the elections. The government cracked it, clamped it down and quieted the people.
On the phone from Tehran, Hamid gave me a sense of the mood amongst opposition supporters there. Just listen to the tone of his voice.
There's no chance. You can't fight bullets with good intentions and sincere hearts. They just beat you. There's no fighting them. We lost it. We went to the street. Our friends got killed. We got beaten, and now we're back. You know, I think it's lost.
Of course, millions of Iranians do support President Ahmadinejad, though the government did proudly boast that 49,600 coaches were used to bus in the huge crowds for this rally last Friday prayers. The most democratic election is held in Iran, declared Mr. Ahmadinejad. The most democratic government of the world is the government of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Last year's election was the freest in the world and the most democratic, he insisted. However democratic it is, the military is taking an ever more visible role in governing the country and controlling the economy. And that could prove very damaging. That's the view of economist Mehrdad Emadi.
There has been a systemic transfer of wealth to Sepah and Basij under the
Sepah, the Revolutionary Guards.
The Revolutionary Guards. And what is going to happen now is that when you have unemployment, there's going to be ordinary people who are going to see the security organs as responsible.
The journalist Mazia Bahari agrees.
I think the weakest point of the regime is the economy. And I think the regime will be toppled because of the economic mismanagement and the corruption that is gnawing the system from within.
Predictions are dangerous, but the Iranian government itself is clearly very nervous about its future.
That report from the BBC's John Line. Well, today, Secretary of Defense Gates said there needs to be more success in Afghanistan for Americans to continue to support that war. Up next, military analyst Andrew Bacevich, who asks, shouldn't we be switching focus anyway to Mexico? That's in 30 seconds, here and now. Military analyst Andrew Bacevich has a very different take on the Gulf disaster. He says it's an issue of national security. Andrew Bacevich is a professor of history and international relations at Boston University. In a recent op-ed in the Boston Globe, he writes that in focusing on distant places like Afghanistan, the U.S. government has taken its eye off problems here at home, where the future of American life is being determined. Professor Bacevich joins us in the studio. Professor, welcome as always.
Thank you very much.
And I don't want to go all Helen Thomas on you, but the now former White House reporter famously asked President Obama why the U.S. was in Afghanistan, and she said, and don't give me that Bushism about how we have to fight them there so they don't come here. But what about that thinking? Because that has been the thinking behind the war in Afghanistan. It is distant, but isn't it also about protecting our shores as much as overseeing oil drilling is?
The story you get in trying to understand U.S. foreign policy, especially U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, depends on where you choose to start the story. I think a very important point to start telling that story is with the promulgation of the Carter Doctrine back in 1980. In other words, long before Osama bin Laden or George W. Bush came along. My sense is that since 1980, the U.S. has been engaged in a massive effort to try to determine the course of events in the greater Middle East. And we've spent at least $1 trillion, and we've lost several thousand lives of American soldiers. And it seems to me it's time for us to take stock and say, what have we gotten for our $1 trillion? Have we got $1 trillion of value for $1 trillion of expenditures laid out? And I think the answer is clearly no. Simultaneously, we here at home have suffered a series of punishing blows, the BP oil disaster being the most recent. And a question that we ought to be asking about our national security priorities is, are we spending the money in the wrong place for the wrong purpose? Rather than trying to pacify the greater Middle East or liberate it, whatever you want to call it.
Or at least bring order to it, order and stability.
Order to it, yeah. Should we not be trying to deal with matters much closer to our own shores?
Well, and boy, the list is pretty long because, as you said, it's not just the current Gulf crisis. You go back to Katrina, 9/11, which actually did happen on our shores, and more recently the economic collapse. And you say that a century ago the U.S. did focus on what you call the near abroad. What do you mean by that?
Well, in the first, roughly three, 4 decades of the 20th century, the focus of attention of the administrations of Teddy Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, was on the Western Hemisphere, was trying to bring order to our neck of the woods. Somehow that understanding of the importance of what's near us got lost, I think, after World War II, and especially in the post-9/11 period. In the piece, I try to make a comparison between Afghanistan and Mexico. I mean, in Afghanistan, we have spent hundreds of billions of dollars, and we are on course to spend hundreds of billions of dollars more to try to modernize this primitive country on the far side of the world. In the meantime, our neighbor Mexico is in the throes of a great crisis related to weak institutions and drug lords and the like. I think anybody thinking about it for 2 seconds would say that the importance of Mexico to our well-being is orders of magnitude greater than the importance of Afghanistan.
But it still seems to keep looping back full circle to that fear. and maybe it's irrational, but people would point to 9/11 and say that it's not, that that is a perfect example of why, you know, you have to spend the money in a place like Afghanistan so that that attack doesn't have on the shore.
Yeah, that is the argument that's made. I think the great flaw in the argument, and frankly, I would buy the argument. If you could tell me with a straight face pacifying Afghanistan would prevent another 9/11, then I think I would sign up to doing whatever was necessary. But the fact of the matter is, violent jihadism is not somehow headquartered or centered in Afghanistan.
Not anymore, anyway.
It is a much broader phenomenon, and therefore, fixing Afghanistan, whatever that entails, is not going to guarantee our security in that regard.
We have two things that you say have to happen. One is reconciling the exercise of freedom with environmental preservation. And again, I would interpret that in the case of the Gulf to mean try to figure out the balance between the free markets of the oil industry and regulation of those free markets, right? Put more emphasis
on that. Yes, I am not a radical tree hugger.
No, you're not.
But I do believe it is incumbent upon us to begin to attend to the erosion in the environment that happens in part because of the way we choose to exercise our freedom. And somehow we have to restore some amount of harmony to the way we choose to live our lives in the modern world and the requirements of sustaining the environment. And I think the BP oil spill is one of those events that really dramatizes the enormity of the task.
And it calls for government to, as you say, pay much more, really focus on it, put time and energy and money and people into it as opposed to focusing on Afghanistan.
And we have to change our own consciousness about what it means to exercise freedom.
Right, there's that. But you also say we have to make our own riotous standard of living acceptable to neighboring countries still wrestling with poverty and underdevelopment. And again, now I'm thinking Mexico.
I'm thinking Mexico. I'm thinking the larger Latin America. I'm thinking the Caribbean.
But I guess my question is, what do you mean by that? Make our riotous standard of living, which is so high compared to so many other countries, acceptable to them. What do you mean by that? Help them have one that's closer to ours?
Exactly. One of the themes in U.S. policy in Afghanistan is that we have assumed the responsibility to somehow help the Afghans enjoy the good aspects of living in the modern world. If we think we have the capacity to do that, then wouldn't it be more important for us to focus our attention on Mexico or on Haiti or on Cuba, which most of us believe is now on the brink of moving into a post-Castro era that is likely to bring about great change there as well.
Just a few nautical miles from the U.S. in Cuba, closer to home.
Much closer.
But just again, one last question. The thinking is that we are doing this in Afghanistan, not because it's a nice thing to do, but because in helping that country come into modernity and have an economy, people would be less likely to turn to the Taliban or al-Qaeda.
We have limited resources to invest in trying to correct problems in parts of the world. Well, which parts of the world matter most? The reigning assumption in Washington is that the greater Middle East matters most. I'm simply trying to suggest that it's time to consider the possibility that what happens here in our own near abroad actually is a lot more important and deserves more attention.
Andrew Bacevich, professor of history and international relations at Boston University. We'll link you to his op-ed at our website, hereandnow.org. By the way, his upcoming book is Washington Rules, America's Path to Permanent War. It comes out in August. We'll have you back then. Professor, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Welcome back. On a recent trip to Palm Springs, we were leaving the hotel for an early morning breakfast just as a 20-something group was turning in. They'd been up all night at the Coachella Festival, hearing acts like Jay-Z, Muse, and the electronic indie band Passion Pit. That's Moth's Wings. You might have heard it. It's been featured on Gossip Girl and Big Love. It's off Passion Pit's latest CD, Manners. They were named the best new band in a poll taken by the Boston Phoenix in 2008. Suddenly, they're drawing huge crowds on college campuses and being showcased at festivals like Coachella. I recently visited with lead singer and songwriter Michael Angelakos and asked him, what was that like?
Well, the entire experience was probably one of the most pivotal moments for us. We had the sunset slot on the outdoor theater stage, and we had somewhere anywhere between a 40 to 60,000-person crowd.
The crowd can either go, oh, this isn't happening, because there's so much there.
Yeah.
Or you can make it over, sort of a divide. Do you feel that you did sort of make it over into sort of like a new territory?
I think the entire, the MO of this band is just taking the next step when we're asked to take the next step. It's all about essentially being able to deliver when you're asked to deliver it.
You did rise to the occasion. I mean, I read the reviews, and it all started in your dorm room at Emerson College here in Boston with you and your laptop. What were you thinking? I'm going to form a band. I want to play with music.
What happened was I'd been kind of suffering from writer's block, because the writing muscle is something that you really need to work and build. And at that point, I was fairly weak. But when you start exploring technology, certain technologies that help with the arrangement of certain kinds of music, it makes it a lot easier to kind of get back into it. And what happened was I discovered a program that made it a lot more visual and easier for me to kind of just sit down, like, oh, you know, and
a software
pump something
program.
Out. Yeah, so pump something out.
What was it, by the way?
It was Ableton Live.
Hold on a second there, because I want to give listeners another taste of what it sounds like. You wrote the first four songs of your first EP, Chunk of Change, as a Valentine's present for your girlfriend. We have one here. It's called I've Got Your Number.
If you listen to Chunk of Change, you're going to hear nothing but imperfection. And I've always been a huge proponent of imperfection in music, because when you listen to an orchestra, you listen to however many violinists playing, not every violinist is playing the exact right note. That's the whole point of it sounding like an orchestra. There's supposed to be that a little bit of a dissonance, because that creates the breath. So what I would do is layer vocals. I designed this vocal sound that was based on imperfection, so that I would create like I remember watching a couple of Truffaut films with a bunch of children screaming, and I wanted to emulate that sound as a and make a vocal sound out of it.
You mentioned your voice, and that's the human part of this, and your voice in particular. First of all, let's listen to a little more. Let's listen to Little Secrets. Michael Angelakis, let's talk about your voice, because it's said to be part of this new wave of falsetto voices, especially in indie bands.
And new wave.
A new wave. you know, sort of like the new Bee Gees. I don't know. It's been written about in the Boston Globe, but the Wild Beasts, the OK Go, all sorts of different groups. When did you discover you had it? And do you guys get together and talk about the fact that, wow, we're a new genre of indie singers singing in high notes?
Right, like as though it hasn't been happening for the past however many years. When I started singing this way, I didn't set out to sing.
Falsetto.
It just cut through the wall of sound, and I realized I had a stronger upper register. I liked the idea that I can make something sound screechy and desperate and move to a very, I guess that there was so much more I could do with my falsetto than with my chest voice. So I just recently went to a vocal doctor. He said that I've essentially mutated my voice to the point where I'm now like 100% a countertenor. And I was never really considered a countertenor until I just started touring and working my voice. Like it's just a muscle like anything else.
Well, let's listen to a little more of your voice. This is Michael Angelakis and the band Passion Pits, Sleepyhead.
This I did in my apartment.
Well, you know, it's no wonder that this is the kind of music that's emerging on the indie scene, because you can do it yourself.
Yeah, I just think, you know, a lot of indie bands have their own studios, and that's something I've been slowly building as I start to make money doing this.
Is that a problem, though, that it's so technical and then you're playing live and, oops, one thing doesn't fire back in time and...
Yeah, welcome to the past 2 years of this band. It's been, I mean, we line the stage with keyboards and samplers, and we do as much as we can to play live as possible. Because I think one attractive element of this band is the fact that we're an electronic band that plays like a rock band, and I think that's one thing I'm very proud of. You know, as much as I, you know, am reliant on studio time and really intense production, we've always made a very concerted effort to make this as human as possible in a live setting, which I think has worked to our advantage.
Well, let's hear some live music. We just heard the apartment recording of Sleepyhead. Let's hear it live.
In terms of the future of this band, the one thing we need to maintain is the energy, which I think is something that has made us a lot of fans. And I can tell you right now that I'm still thinking that it's going to take us about 6 months to another 2 years to get to where we... You have to understand, when we came into the spotlight, that was our gestation period only, and there is no... there's no time for a band to just become a band anymore. And learn to be a band and work as a band.
It's like, boom, you're there.
Yeah, boom. And of course, it's all documented and archived online. So everyone can go on YouTube and be like, God, that band's awful. So, well, that was actually our third show. So
unfortunately, a month ago.
Yeah. And it's so hard for music listeners to put that into perspective, because everything's just gotten so much shorter and more temporary and fleeting that it's actually very hard to be in a band right now and really prove yourself when... we're so production-based. So I think we just need time and a lot more hard work and things like Coachella under our belt to really be put in a position where I can come back and say to you, I think we're happy where we are. But that wouldn't be interesting if we were totally happy about it. And once all those problems are solved, I think I'm going to get pretty bored. I like problem solving.
Well, Michael Angelakos, we wish you a lot of luck. Again, the band Passion Pit, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you very much.